This is James Corbett of The Corbett Report coming to you on the 18th day of July 2011 here in Japan. And across the dateline, I'm joined by Peter Dale Scott, the author of such books as Drugs, Oil, and War, The United States in Afghanistan, Colombia, and Indochina, and American War Machine, Deep Politics, The CIA Global Drug Connection, and The Road to Afghanistan. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you back on the program today, Peter Dale Scott. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I'd like to start off today by talking about the latest development in Afghanistan, where obviously the brother of the President Karzai, Ahmed Wali Karzai, was recently gunned down, killed by Sardar Mohammed, who it turns out actually has a CIA connection and has two brothers-in-law who work for a CIA-run paramilitary unit and who himself has CIA connections. And this is particularly interesting because it turns out, of course, also Ahmed Wali Karzai was on the CIA payroll and also happened to be one of the largest heroin dealers in Afghanistan. So a lot of very interesting connections going on with this story. Your thoughts on the latest developments here?
Well, I don't know who was behind. I'm sure somebody was behind. It wasn't a personal thing. But why this killing is so important for the politics of Afghanistan and the drug trade in Afghanistan is that Ahmed Wali Karzai, the half-brother of Hamid Karzai, was the main power in Kandahar. And Kandahar, most of the drugs now are grown in the south. And it's really virtually impossible, I think, for somebody to be in power in Kandahar and not be deeply involved in the drug trade, because the drug trade is the way that part of it's the economy for that part of the country. It's basically the economy for the whole of Afghanistan, or the dominant element, but it is totally the economy of Kandahar. And you take his Ahmed Wali Karzai's predecessor, who was Gul Aga Sherzai. He was a CIA asset and probably one of the biggest drug traffickers in the country, possibly even more directly involved in the drug trade than Ahmed Wali Karzai. And before that, you had, what was his name, Akhundzada. The DEA found, I think, 9 tons of heroin in his office. And when that hit the news, he couldn't be the governor of Kandahar anymore. So they made a big announcement that Akhundzada would no longer be the governor in Kandahar. But at the end of the announcement, he said he's being appointed to the Senate. So you see how involved the Karzai government in Kabul, which has a tenuous control even over the north, but is the heart of the opposition is coming from the Pashtuns in the south. And to maintain any kind of control over the south, they appoint somebody who's connected both to the government and to the drug trade. And that's just the way it is. And this has to be stressed, particularly for an American audience, because if they're reading the American media, they're always hearing about drugs in the Taliban, drugs in the Taliban. Well, it is true that the Taliban, like everyone else, are being financed by the drug trade as well. But their share, the Taliban's share of the drug trade is relatively small compared to the coalition of local powers, warlords, whatever you want to call them, throughout the country, who have made an alliance with Karzai. Sometimes you could say they're like Ahmed Wali Karzai, obviously very close to Karzai. Some others like Dostum in the north and Ismail Khan in Herat, their allegiance is very tenuous. But they, all of these people, I think, it's not that they are criminal by instinct or inclination, it's that that is the name of the game of power in Afghanistan. And I never stop saying that America plays a great share of the responsibility for this by having deliberately, consciously destabilized Afghanistan back in 78, 79, in order, is Brzezinski virtually boasted later on, in order to draw the Soviets in, to use Brzezinski's phrase, to give the Soviet Union their Vietnam. Brzezinski probably thought that was pretty clever at the time, but we have this disaster, which it's hard to see any end to, really, because it's conflict that has bred the drug trade. And I want America to stop putting boots on the ground in Afghanistan, but I have no illusion. I don't think for a second that that means there will be an end to the conflict. It will perhaps remake it again an Afghan conflict if we can keep other great powers out. But one of the things that the drug trade is doing is people are exporting their drugs and bringing back in arms for the coming battle that everyone foresees when the United States is no longer the chief power in the country. So it's a terrible situation, and the one easy thing to say is that it was a mistake for America to stir things up there in the first place.
Indeed. Well, you raise the point that in the American media, the drugs and the Taliban are always linked in the popular imagination and in the media, but we saw the rather remarkable development last year of using the excuse that, of course, the Taliban can profit from the drug trade, that the U.S. military now has an official policy of guarding and protecting the opium crops, the poppies, the fields. And we saw reporting from ABC News and from Fox News and other media outlets actually reporting from the field and interviewing the troops who are actually now guarding the poppy fields. Right. Not remarkable, I suppose, insofar as it was unexpected or unknown by those who have been following it, but perhaps remarkable for the fact that the media is now openly covering this fact. What do you make of those kinds of developments and the now open admission of this type of activity?
Well, of course, progressively over the years, it's become clearer and clearer that the coalition that Karzai is at the head of is a coalition of people whose local authority is linked to the drug trade. So it's not a secret. And, of course, and I think that I myself, just in recent weeks, had not realized to which having the drug trade throughout the country has so criminalized the security forces, the police, and to some extent the Afghan army, that we are seeing a great rise in other forms of crime as well, kidnapping, child prostitution, really virtually child slavery, that children are kidnapped and put in, not for ransom, but just to be put into brick factories or refineries. It's time to be, we should welcome the fact that the media are beginning to see that Afghanistan has what is essentially a drug economy, and that the planning for the future has to take this into account. Nobody has a very good solution. The Russians are pushing the Americans to go into crop eradication, which America tried for a while, but they realized that that was just driving people into the arms of the Taliban, so they've given it up. And I'm glad they have, because the peasants are not the instigators of the trade. They're faced with a choice where they can grow wheat or they can grow poppy. And I think that it's a ratio of like 30 to 2 or something, the relative difference in price. There are certain solutions, I think, that could be contemplated, but they're not contemplated because we're not confronting the problem in Afghanistan. The solution that I prefer personally is the so-called Sonlis solution, after a group in Europe who put it forward, which is just to, you want to get rid of the traffickers, well, buy the crop legally. And this is very unpopular in Washington, and they say, well, what are you going to do with all those drugs? Well, the Sonlis answer is, you make opiates available to medical facilities in the third world, who are very undersupplied at present. So it's not a utopian idea, and I think it's not an ideal idea. That a real danger is if you start paying legally for the opium, that in effect encourages people to grow it again. So I'm not saying there's no downside to this, but given the present situation where illegality reigns and all kinds of crime is being fostered, and we're getting ready for a civil war that is being funded by arms brought in with the profits from the drug trade, it seems to me that is the most sensible way to go.
Well, you make the very important and I think obvious distinction between the peasants who are really growing these poppies as sustenance, as a necessity, and then, of course, the drug trade itself, which is an entirely different beast. And we can take a look at the idea of a drug trade. Obviously, there is a way in which this heroin is leaving the country and is getting out to Europe eventually and to America, and 90% of the world's heroin is supplied from Afghanistan. So obviously, yeah, the drug trade must...
Russia. You should absolutely mention Russia, because it's probably the single country most impacted by this trade. And again, you don't see much reference to that in the American press, but one of the things that we have done is create not just a major health problem for Russia, but a major security problem for Russia, because the drug trade there is largely in the hands of militant Islamist groups like Al-Qaeda, groups which America has used in various parts of the world in the past. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's the
point. Not at all. That's an important distinction to make, and it's important to point out, because as you say, it's not being pointed out in the media. But I guess my broader point is, obviously, these crops and the drug itself are leaving the country. There must be a way in which this is being facilitated. These drugs aren't just walking out by themselves. What can you tell us about the routes that these are leaving through, and what countries they pass through, and how that trade is being facilitated?
Well, they literally go out east, west, south, and north. Some go west through Iran, but Iran, of all the neighbors, is the one country which is battling the drug trade most severely, because for Iran, too, it's a security threat. And I'm embarrassed to say that the CIA has been meddling it. One of its assets in Iran is a Baluchi group on the southeastern border of Iran, which faces Afghanistan. And the CIA are using them as an insurgent group in Iran, and they support themselves largely by the drug trade. Some of it goes to Pakistan, the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence. It's estimated that a third of their income comes directly from the drug trade. And this goes back to the 1980s, when America money went to the ISI to fight the Russians in Afghanistan, and they gave it all to a man called Hekmatyar, who became for a while perhaps the world's leading heroin trafficker, and actually began the practice of processing opium into heroin, which was unheard of before in this region, and is now, I think, more than half of Afghan opium goes directly into heroin before it leaves the country. Some of it goes south to the Gulf states, and happening when there used to be an Afghan airline, Ariana, and it was known as a drug airline because it flew down to the Emirates, and apparently huge amounts went that way. I don't know how active that is now. And finally, a lot of the drugs reaching Russia come north through Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and have totally corrupted the governments in those two countries. We had a coup and then violence last year in Kyrgyzstan, which seems to have been I can't speak for the present government, but in 2005 we had a coup, which I'm afraid some Americans were behind in Kyrgyzstan, which essentially put in a government which took over the drug trade and ran it directly. So it's pouring out in all directions. And in addition, you know, America has made is boasting of the fact that they virtually eradicated opium production in the north. I think you have to make an exception for Badakhshan, but generally in the north, it's, opium production has gone way down. But a lot of these people are saying, all right, you don't want us to grow opium, so we'll grow marijuana. And this is a more traditional crop, actually, in Afghanistan, but it's it wasn't traditional for it to be such an export commodity. Afghanistan is now the number one hashish exporter in the world. It used to be Morocco, another CIA-supported government, but now it's Afghanistan, and this too is destabilizing. It's part of the political. It has political consequences because it is smuggled by groups that use it for to build up their local forces.
Well, obviously, opium does not process itself into heroin. That in itself is a process that requires certain chemicals and certain agents. I mean, how is that being done, and who are the main groups behind that?
I can't name groups, but I've thought a lot about this, and what I'm saying now is a bit speculative, but I think it holds up. This all began, the first processing was done by Europeans, and according to the French, Americans who started coming to Afghanistan in the 1970s. Now, if we think about what was happening in the 1970s, America was pulling out of Indochina. Up until then, Burma, Laos, northern Thailand, the so-called Golden Triangle, it had totally dominated the global production of opium. But as the Americans pulled out, the political system that protected the traffickers and so on was beginning to collapse. And it's quite striking that as the Americans pulled out of Vietnam, opium production in the triangle went down, and at the same time, simultaneously, opium production in the Golden Crescent, between the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, began to increase. And the same pattern again repeated in the 90s. You still had a certain amount of opium production in the 1990s in the Golden Triangle, but there was a very energetic UN-backed program to do crop substitution, to terminate, to eliminate opium production in the triangle. You cannot say it's been eliminated, but in the 90s it did go down. And the interesting thing is, and here the statistics are really remarkable, as it went down in the triangle, it increased in the Golden Crescent, so that the total production between the two areas was roughly the same. Why do I stress that? Because it seems to me that the real impetus for all of this is not coming locally from indigenous elements in either one place or the other, but it is coming from a global drug trade that is probably Western-based and was certainly, clearly, with the, I write about this in American War Machine, with the advantage of historical retrospection, we see how important the CIA was for the building up of, because it was an enormous increase initially, right after the war, of drug production in the Golden Triangle. The CIA is probably the primary reason why you saw such dramatic increase in production. And so we have to ask ourselves, why are we now looking at the Golden Crescent, where, again, drug production increased at the same time that CIA involvement increased? They always say it was indirect through ISI, but it was still, I mean, America put billions of dollars into Afghanistan in the 1980s, and it went, the two groups, Abu Sayyaf and Hekmatyar's group, Hezbi Islami, which were, because they were not very popular in Afghanistan, they compensated for that by using the drug trade to build up their power. So we have to, if we really are saying, what are we going to do about drugs in Afghanistan, we have to look at these external forces. We have to look at Washington, I'm afraid, and do something there. Legalize drugs, certainly legalize marijuana as a first step. And the solutions to this drug crisis will come on the demand side, because you can take the profits out of the drug trade by legalizing it.
But of course, the people who have a vested interest in keeping those profits would be obviously against the legalization. So what does that mean, given the fact that legalization is pretty much untenable or unspeakable in Washington?
Well, you're absolutely right. I'm just saying that we have a problem, by the way, which is, you know, not going to go away. No one should think that if America just pulls out of Afghanistan that drugs will cease there, because now it is more. I mean, you had a relatively prosperous Thailand that was beginning to develop a real mixed economy to replace the drug economy. Nothing like that's happening in Afghanistan. There will be some export of raw materials and things, possibly a pipeline or two, but it's a very real problem, and there won't be any solutions until we see what the problem is, what are the major forces driving the problem. And that's why I think it's good to point things out, even though you're absolutely right. There is no chance today that Washington would legalize drugs. Banks are, you know, illegal drug money laundering has affected virtually all the major banks in America. The one bank, it's gone now, Wachovia Bank, admitted to processing over 100 million, but the real figure was probably much higher than that. But it's wrong to single out the Wachovia Bank, because the real profits, another factor which is not mentioned enough, is that probably 80% of the profits in the drug trade are not made in the country of origin. They're made in the countries of consumption. They estimate that the drug the dollar amount of drugs leaving Afghanistan is $4 billion, but the total drug I'm just talking about opium heroin here. Opiate, the total opiate market, which is 93% of it coming from Afghanistan, the total market is something like at least 60-65 billion. So you can see that the $4 billion that Afghanistan makes out of this is small potatoes compared to the money that's made in the countries of consumption. And that money is banked in Western banks. And we had Mr. Da Costa, the head of the UN Drug Office, who said that he knew of banks that only survived the crisis in 2008 because of the drug money that flowed into them. And there was a congressional report that said, I'm now talking about total illegal funds, not just opium money, but that illegal money accounted for $500 billion to $1 trillion of banking business a year in the United States. So we're talking about big business here. And some people like James Petras have said we should call the American economy a narco-economy, not for what we grow in the country, but for what we bank in the country. And the financial interests are the most powerful interests in America today. So it's no surprise that there are very few friends for the idea of a rational drug policy in Congress.
Well, then finally today, on the subject of reducing the drug trade or even eliminating it, obviously the Taliban came the closest to doing that during their time in power in Afghanistan. So what can you say about the policies that they had to try to eliminate the opium crop versus what the Americans have since instituted with the record-breaking amounts of opium being produced now in the country?
Well, of course, you're absolutely right. The total production of opium in Afghanistan dropped from, I think, about 3,000 tons in 2000 to 185 tons in 2001. That was the Taliban, the year the Taliban banned it. And most of that 185 came from the areas not under Taliban control, up in the northeast under the Northern Alliance, because there's no doubt about the question that when America went in to fight the Taliban in 2001, it overcame its reluctance to join with the Northern Alliance because they knew the Northern Alliance was a drug trafficking concern. And there were some people in the CIA felt it was time for the CIA to outgrow this habit of working with drug traffickers, but they decided not to outgrow the habit, and they went in. And, of course, the production went way back up. It's not clear that a ban for 1 year, which is what the Taliban managed to do, would have become permanent. There are many cynics who say, well, when the Taliban banned the output, the production of opium, it was at a time when opium stocks were overextended, and it could have been seen as a kind of market-driven in order to get opium prices back up. I don't know one way or another. I just do know that it certainly proves that it can be done. It's possible the Taliban was able to use force on the ground. They weren't competing at that point. There was the Taliban in Afghanistan, and so the peasants didn't have anyone else to look to. It shows that it can be done. I'm not sure that it shows that it's easy to do. But certainly, the ultimate solution, I think, will have to be at all ends, on the financial end, on the consumption end, on the production end, and better security on the borders to deal with the trafficking end. A little more credit to Iran, whom we continually demonize in America, but they are the most effective drug fighting force in that region today. And then, of course, you would have to rethink policy towards Pakistan, because the CIA, more than any other power, is responsible for having delivered Pakistan into the hands of its intelligence agency, which grew like a cancer in the 1980s and has become a drug trafficking agency itself, with its own interests in preserving drugs in a post-American Pakistan. So at all of these levels have to be approached simultaneously.
All right, Professor Peter Dale Scott, tell us about American War Machine and the information it contains and how people can get a copy.
Oh, thank you. Well, bookstores are vanishing right and left, but there's still Amazon. I began it originally to write about the drug traffic and the responsibility of the CIA for building up the post-war drug traffic. But as I wrote it, I realized that much more had been involved than just the drug traffic in Southeast Asia, which was what I was writing about. This had given the Pentagon and the CIA the opportunity to think of rolling back communism, they not using American armies, but using proxy armies in Southeast Asia that were directly funded by the drug trade. Now, it's quite well known that the first American attempt to do this was to build up a Kuomintang KMT pro-Chiang Kai-shek remnant army in Burma. And that's been written about a great deal and written off as a kind of fiasco. What has not been written about, and I wanted to draw attention to, was that in the 1950s, the CIA started fresh by building up its own proxy army in Thailand, nominally part of the Thai Border Patrol, But in fact, a CIA creation, and one which the man who started it for the CIA admitted in an oral history that they funded their activities by the KMT armies would grow the drugs in Burma and bring it down into Thailand. And then this was all by prearrangement. His group, Paru, P-A-R-U, Paru would go up, raid the camp, the KMT having withdrawn. So there was maybe a few token shots were fired, but it was not a battle. Then the Paru people would take the opium down to Bangkok and get a reward for turning it in. And that's what funded Paru. Paru started the Second Indochina War, which we think of as the Vietnam War. But it actually began in Laos. It began with an army coming in from Thailand, this Paru, and helping to oust a democratically elected neutralist president. You have to remember that Alan Dulles equated neutralists with communists. This was the beginning of active rollback. America became involved in a war of its own creation using this proxy army, which they then supplemented with a Hmong drug-financed army. And I hope someday the histories of the Vietnam War will be enlarged to look at Laos and I think that why America cared so much for Laos, which is a beautiful, peaceful, chaotic country. You can't even call it a state because there are 100 languages spoken there. The Laos they are not even the majority. I think that they were hoping to draw in China. There are a lot of particular things that happened in that war that look as if they were trying to induce China to attack. This was before China had its own nuclear weapons. And we know that there were people who in America, initially they wanted to nuke Russia. And as late as Kennedy, they were still talking about a unilateral nuclear attack on Russia. Kennedy absolutely forbade that, so they talked instead about nuking China. And we had another unnecessary war. I mean, all of these wars, Laos, Vietnam, Afghanistan, they make no sense in terms of American security. They were... But they do make sense in terms of the drug trade, unfortunately, and they do make sense in terms of creating these powerful international forces that we can count on to be essentially capitalist because they're in it for the money, and which America has used as allies first in Thailand, then in Laos, then in Afghanistan, and in other countries.
All right, a fascinating subject and a lot more to be said, but obviously people can consult your books on this subject and begin learning from there. So, Professor Peter Dale Scott, I know you're a busy man. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Jim.